Hello everyone, and welcome to this episode of our podcast mini-series Getting to Better Together, which is sponsored by the Centre for International Development, Social Entrepreneurship and Leadership at the University of the Sunshine Coast, and supported by Noosa Radio FM 101.3. I am your host, Richard Borden. As always, before proceeding further, I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, the Gubbi Gubbi people, and pay my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. As the impacts of the warming climate on the world about us are becoming ever more evident, so we're being led to ask ourselves questions that, until now, have not really entertained our individual thoughts or our collective mind with any sense of urgency or criticality. How have things got to this, and how should we now be responding? What should I, we, they be doing as the world about us is changing so dramatically? What could I, we, they be doing to better adapt to the dynamic changes that we're experiencing as the planet continues to warm, and or to mitigate its impacts? The bush is burning with increasing frequency and ferocity, destroying everything, including houses, in its wake. Whole townships are being isolated by raging floods following drenching rains. Our beaches are being eroded, and the foundations of our foreshore houses are being washed away by rising tides and violent storms. Extended heat waves are posing very severe health hazards, particularly to the elderly and other vulnerable members of our communities. Prolonged droughts are depressing farm productivity and distorting the availability, accessibility, and affordability of food. And it's already costing a matzo. What do we do in the face of all of these circumstances that are only to get more extreme as the future continues to unfold? And perhaps more basically, what do we need to know and to understand as the basis for the actions that we need to take? In a recent episode in this mini-series, I talked of the significance of three different ways of knowing and bodies of knowledge, which have really emerged as incredibly fundamental in this modern industrial era: ecological, economic, and ethical. These, I argued, were not just appropriate but critical foundations for responsible judgments in the face of current and potential challenges to our current ways of behaving. Ecology reveals the nature and significance of interrelationships within nature and between living systems and their dynamic environments, including, of course, the climate, the atmosphere. Economics helps us to understand costs and benefits, optimal resource uses, and consumer choices, while ethics allows us to judge our actions from the perspective of moral concern for the good, the just, the fair, the equitable, and the responsible. What does all this mean in practice? Can we provide examples of where these three ways of knowing have helped us, are helping us, to at least clarify the issues? In today's episode, I want to explore some of these matters with my guest, Dr. Jane Palmer. Welcome, Jane.
Nice to be here, Richard.
Jane is an adjunct fellow at the University of Technology in Sydney. Her research interests, including the use of storytelling methods in post-conflict or marginalised communities to explore the processes of trauma, grief, resilience, and adaptation. She has undertaken fieldwork in Indonesia and in regional and remote Australia, and has published in the areas of ethics, fieldwork methodologies, Indigenous studies, and future studies. As I understand it, Jane, you started your fieldwork in Indonesia in Aceh only about a half a dozen years following the truly terrible tsunami that hit there on Boxing Day 2004. That took over 160,000 lives, destroyed countless villages along the coast, and displaced a literal multitude of people from their homes and places of business. It was clearly an ecological disaster that's been associated with overwhelming economic consequences, while presenting a host of ethical challenges when responses are being considered. Jane, could you give us some indication of the nature of the impacts and the consequences and challenges of that terrible event, and some of the ethical aspects that have arisen in response?
Thanks, Richard, for that introduction. I guess one of the ways to approach those dimensions of drastic disaster like a tsunami is for me to tell you a story, perhaps, about an Ibu whom I interviewed in Aceh, who lives in a seaside village, a very poor seaside village that where livelihoods are mainly based on fishing and small crops in the mountains, like growing chilies and onions and so on. Mm-hmm. So the village is very beautiful. As you approach it, it's on this beautiful bay of calm silver water. It's the people there are just really wonderful people, but their entire village was completely obliterated by this 15 metre high wall of black water that landed on the shore on Boxing Day 2004, and I was there in 2008. So it was very recently after the tsunami, and I spoke to this Ibu who was 90 years old, and she talked about how people had returned to that site to rebuild the village several times. And in fact, there'd been two tsunamis she'd lived through before the Boxing Day tsunami.
Wow.
And you could see some of the village has actually sunk into the ocean. And if you take up yourself in a helicopter, you can actually see a drowned mosque out in the ocean, which one archaeologist has been studying. So I talked to her about what happened during the tsunami, about the numbers of deaths, massive, I mean, huge numbers of people in the village died. But she said she wanted to return to that place because it was where livelihoods, her children's and her grandchildren's livelihoods were. And what the government, of course, had done, they said, well, look, you can't go back and resettle after the 2004 tsunami. We're establishing a 2-kilometre no-go zone along the coastline for people's safety, and because it just would have been another economic and you know, human disaster. But in fact, what happened was that all the communities along that coastline began to... They united as one with the help of an amazing community development NGO called Uplink, and put a petition to the government and said, we want to go back to where our livelihoods are. You know, we believe we have the right to choose where to live. So they ended up convincing the government somehow to repeal that 2-kilometre no-go zone. And partly because people actually went back and started rebuilding themselves little houses in the area. And I think the government just realised that it wasn't viable to relocate all of them. So, but it raised interesting issues because the government sees it as a risk, and yet there are still not really very good escape routes, not very good facilities for the next tsunami. So those people remain very, very poor and very poorly serviced, even though they've been allowed to go back into that zone. So I think that's an issue about what we do to support people and whether resilience amounts to simply going back to being as poor as you were before the tsunami. Mm.
Well, it makes an interesting issue, doesn't it, in terms of where we talk about getting to better together. The implies the fact that we're talking about the future, that will be better. Whereas in many circumstances, and this may well be one of them, at least for short periods, is that it's getting to better together by going backwards, by going back to where we were before.
Mm.
And I wonder how much that is on the minds of people now as we begin to address things. And maybe it's too late indeed for us to go back to where we were before.
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think in terms of climate justice, it's too late to go back to where we were before. But First Nations people have made a very interesting point in terms of looking at futures. They've said that for them, they're already in a dystopia. Mm-hmm. So we look to the future and think, my goodness, if we don't do something about climate change or, you know, better resilience to these natural disasters, we'll be entering a dystopia. But First Nations people have already had their land destroyed, their cultural artifacts destroyed, been dispossessed. There's a very moving video about First Nations people in Greenland and in the Bikini Islands, where, for example, all those nuclear tests were conducted. And what's been left is wasteland, often by Western nuclear tests. So First Nations people feel that they're already in a position where their life is dystopian, and that needs to be taken account of when we look at what we might do for the future.
Mm. And it's not just the economics, is it? It's not just the livelihoods. It's also things associated with one's culture, one's spiritual artifacts, as it were, exactly. And spirit itself, in terms of I have a spiritual attachment to land,
yes,
type notion.
Exactly.
Which we, I believe, find very difficult to understand.
Yes, I think we do. We've learnt nothing really from Aboriginal people in Australia or from people in the Pacific Islands or the Americas. I think we've just seen land as a commodity, and it's not country, it's just land. And you can clear it and you can make money out of it. And I think that's something we could learn. I think First Nations voices are becoming stronger in that regard, and the Rio Tinto blowing up of Juncan Gorge was an example of where that's being brought to public attention. I think commodification of everything is the way we've gone, and now we're paying the price for that.
Listening to the stories of people in Aceh, particularly the elderly who've been through, as you've suggested already, a number of natural disasters already, plus presumably also political and social ones prior to, within a lifetime, for instance, what have you gained in terms of what people really want? In terms of going back to the past, presumably if the past was particularly violent, they didn't want to go back to that. But what was it they were trying to avoid? If they had a vision, what would their vision be, do you think?
Well, I think they probably want for themselves and most for the next generation, which is what they referred to all the time. I interviewed mainly older people. Mm-hmm. All of them were concerned for future generations, and what they wanted was safety and security, because there had been the 30-year conflict, secessionist movement in Aceh, and the conflict with the Indonesian military as a result, which had killed many, many people. So I think possibly 10,000 people had died as a result of that conflict before the tsunami, and another 170,000 people died as a result of the tsunami. And the tsunami, in a sense, was a circuit breaker. So I think the Indonesian government realised that they couldn't continue to let their military wreak havoc in the province of Aceh when Aceh had just gone through this terrible event. So it did bring about a peace process, which was brokered in Helsinki. I think that's why one of the things that concerned those people, even when I talked about the tsunami, to them that was more an act of God. And I think that's another interesting ethical and political issue, because actions by the Indonesian military were seen as acts of humans, and people would say things like, I can't accept that. I can't accept that a fellow human being would torture or do this to my family. Mm. Whereas the tsunami, as an act of God, is somehow doesn't wreak such spiritual and psychological devastation, I think. It's something they've lived through before, and yes, it killed many people. But I think as climate change, which is anthropogenic, progresses, they are seen certainly by activists at peak meetings around the world where they have a voice. It's seen as an act of humans, and that makes it harder to accept.
That's an important point, isn't it? Yeah, it's not just spiritual connection with land. It's actual spiritual connection with each other, as it were.
Yes, yes. And what's seen as inhumane is different from an act of God. But, of course, the consequences of tsunamis, as people have recently written about, are much worse with climate change, with anthropogenic climate change. The flooding is worse. The water proceeds further inland and wreaks more devastation. Mm. So climate change has a role to play in how badly people are affected by this act of God as well.
If my history was correct, Aceh was one of the earliest places in Indonesia to welcome Mohammedism, Islam?
Yes, it is. It's called Mecca's Veranda.
Okay.
And it was seen as an alternative place to perform the Hajj pilgrimage if you couldn't get to Mecca. So it has a very important Islamic history.
Does it remain what you might call religious?
Yes, it is. There's it's a very strong, very strong.
Hence this distinction between God and man.
Yes, and a very great gentleness. I think people have such the wrong idea of Islam. I remember one old man and the other people in the room agreed with him. He just said, he asked me what religion I was, and I must admit I slightly obfuscated and said Christian, when in fact I'm not really any religion. And he just said, your religion is your religion and our religion is our religion. And there's a huge gentleness and acceptance of all sorts of things. And I just think that people forget that it's actually a very kindly and very, very community-minded, caring for each other religion as well.
That's certainly also my experience working with Iranians and in Iran. It's a sort of almost surprise that we don't know that.
Yes.
You've seen all the wrong side, as it were. But that's also true of most religions that I can think of.
Yes. Know, sort of, and the media, of course, loves the stories of, the three Islamic individuals who did this So I think their religion has helped the Achaemenids to survive. But on the other hand, they haven't received, in my view and in many people's view, I think the support they need to be resilient in the sense of feeling that safety and security for the future. It's impoverishment, basically.
One of the interpretations one might say of looking at the future from the point of view of escaping from the past is that there's actually more to it than that, isn't there? The sort of notion of thinking about the past into a future. So there's a nexus between the past and into the future without seeing it from the point of view of escaping the bad.
No, exactly. I mean, they're people's history is hugely important for their future. And I just think that I'll have to pause here because I need to think that through. But it's a very history provides people with a great deal of strength and resilience and identity and all sorts of things, and it's a continuum, you know. The whole process in Australia at present of truth-telling, treaty and voice, the truth-telling is learning about the past and acknowledging it the settlers acknowledging the pain that was caused, and without grasping that nettle, rather than simply trying to trample it and avoid it, I don't think Australia has much. It has a haunted future, basically. I think we're going to be always haunted by that denial and obfuscation, you know.
I think about that a lot, and regular listeners to this podcast series will know, I often reflect upon that statement about paying my respects to the elders. And in my case, that really does include appreciation of the fact that their way of knowing is quite different to ours, beyond spirituality, which is also profoundly important. But the notion of the way they understand reality, they being Indigenous peoples virtually everywhere in the world, the understanding the nature of reality and their, as humans, their role in it, their functions within it, their part within it, and so on, and also the way they then create knowledge, quite different from the sort of reasoned enlightenment science, so-called, the scientific way of looking at things, with evidence that we base then on theories that we ourselves create. Whereas, as I understand it, Indigenous peoples have different ways of actually grounding what it is that they know.
Yes, I believe they do. And I can't speak for them because I would get it wrong, almost certainly.
Yeah, yeah, I feel the same. Yes.
But yes, there is. I mean, that's part of the reason for, you know, the voice, I guess, and truth-telling, is perhaps we might learn to understand a little bit better those different epistemologies. And I think we have a lot to learn, but even if we don't end up somehow in confluence with those other epistemologies, at least it might create more respect for the people who have different ways of knowing.
Epistemology is ways of knowing and knowledge.
And it's just, to me, that... transdisciplinary approach of coming to understand another's epistemology. I think often our epistemologies are just completely incommensurate and you can't understand it, but what you can do is respect it and somehow work with it.
I think about that in terms of, I look at political statements about what the voice is about, to me, again, skates over the notion of, we really, when we have a voice, we need to be listening. We really have to have the patience to listen to the stories rather than just the history.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Well, to me, I found in my field work, one of the wonderful things about a story is that you realise that all these things, these historical events, happened in one person's lifetime.
Mm.
And there's an accretion there of events that I think we don't appreciate. So a lot of the Aboriginal people I've spoken with out west have been through, you know, the stolen children generation. They've been moved from their lands. They still can't see relatives who were shifted a long way away. Mm. They've had terrible, and they live in poor conditions. And I think that we need to realise that these aren't just historical events or movements. They're actually things that happened in people's lives, and they've accrued over time. And so, and then they accrue over generations. So you get intergenerational impacts as well. So that's what stories are good at revealing, that these are not sort of discrete events, one after the other chronologically.
In your field work, did they ever test your patience?
Did field work ever test my patience?
In terms of having to listen, not having to, but wanting to listen to stories, which can often be
never.
Protracted.
Every story was absolutely fascinating.
Isn't that lovely? Yeah.
Yes, and partly because the people I interviewed in my field work, there was every single one of them was lovely and so amazing in the fact that they shared their story, because they're traumatic stories. The old people I interviewed, the really old ones, had lived through Dutch colonisation and being forced to work for the Dutch. They'd lived through the very cruel Japanese occupation. Then they'd lived through, during World War II, then they'd lived through the Darul Islam movement and the Chumbok Rebellion, all of which caused deaths. And then they lived through the 30-year secessionist conflict, and then they had the tsunami. So these older people had really seen more than anyone, you know, should never be able to see, such a series of events in their life. So, and they shared them. And even though you could tell that they were very, very painful memories of being held at gunpoint by the military, they still thought that my research was important, and they said to me, we want to help your research, and such incredibly generous people, because I wasn't really offering them anything in return, you know. So I felt, I think that storytelling can be quite painful for people, and one needs to be aware of that. But
is that an art we can recover?
Well, I think anthropologists, ethnographers have got it. You know, I think they do listen to stories, and they
do, but I mean, we as a general public, with our sense of urgency about everything except fixing up climate change, as I said, I used the word before, patience. Resilient people, it seems to me, they're one of their major attributes is the fact that they are patient.
Yes.
That there is no point in going off, you know, it's a sort of, it's happened. It's a sort of, not a level of fatalism, but almost optimism, in the sense that, well, it will get better.
Yes, otherwise, or we'll get through this.
Or we'll get through this, yeah.
Yes, combined with grief. Grief's a very strong feeling as well in all those people, because they all lost children and spouses and grandchildren. Lots of little babies died in the tsunami in Aceh. So, I think in terms of storytelling, I just don't know whether we do that very well. I mean, obviously the ABC does stories. People love to listen to stories. Australian Story on the ABC is presumably well watched. So there's a kind of yearning for stories, but there's also a warning that others have issued to not kind of homogenise stories. So, for example, people talk about the refugee story you know, the survivor story, and yet every refugee has their own story, and I think that's where patience comes in.
That's one of the faults of history, isn't it? That we just generalise and homogenise events as if we all did that.
Exactly.
But of course we didn't.
And as if one person didn't live through all of them.
Yeah, that's right.
That accrual of trauma. Mm. Yes. I think Uplink is an extraordinary NGO because they worked to rebuild houses in Aceh after the tsunami, and they were so patient. They literally, one person described them as relentlessly community development oriented or community engagement oriented.
Nice criticism.
And they, yes, they spent, it took it longer, but they, in enabling the entire community to be involved in planning and rebuilding. It apparently rebuilt social capital. Mm. It meant that women were involved in decision making and building as well as the men. It was an extraordinary process, and yet it does take time, and you've got to listen to what people really want.
Yeah, and hear.
Mm. Yes, yeah.
Jane, this has been terrific. Thank you for your stories.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Richard. Sort of,
the extraordinary breadth and depth of your scholarship in terms of trying to understand all these immensely complex issues again illustrate to me the point of the significance of ecology, economics and ethics, because it, from my perspective, helps me make sense out of all of this complexity. So thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, Richard. Thank you for inviting me.
And thank you all for listening, and I look forward very much indeed to our next episode. Thank you and goodbye.